day in Studio 360, Sex, Lies, and a Curtain Call. The filmmaker Steven Soderbergh, the Aaron Brockovich and Ocean's 11, 12, and 13 guy, says goodbye, Hollywood.
When you reach the point where you're like, if I have to get into another van to do another scout, I'm just going to shoot myself. It's time to let somebody else get in the van.
Say goodbye to Hollywood.
And later, we deconstruct a monumental rock album, brick by brick.
For a record that's directed at a 15-year-old, it's very heavy.
Three decades later, Pink Floyd's The Wall is still pretty heavy. Plus, the silent magician Teller speaks, and what he's got to say is a little freaky.
The dead are inside us, and we should be really happy about that.
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Later this hour, we'll visit a magic show where the tricks are definitely not for kids.
No one has ever before wanted to bring an audience member up on stage, kill him, and dissolve his body in acid. We wanted to do that.
The magician Teller talks and talks about his new work as a theatrical auteur. But first,
my concern is that this is headed to the Red Scare era and towards, you know, McCarthyism. What's to stop this from becoming the next House on American Activities Committee hearing, right? Like, this sounds like a witch hunt to me.
This week in Washington, the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security held a hearing on the, quote, radicalization of American Muslims.
And these congressional hearings can better inform you and me about what's going on among the jihadists.
The thing about congressional hearings like this, whether it's exploited farm workers or violence in video games, is that they don't really exist to unearth facts. They are political PR stunts intended to draw public attention to an issue, to rile up citizens. And that's where Wajahat Ali comes in. Ali is a playwright and a lawyer whose work tries to calm those tensions. He's a practicing Muslim who grew up in the Bay Area after his parents emigrated from Pakistan. He says that American Muslims partly have themselves to blame for not more assertively telling their story. So, Wajahat, if you had testified to the House Homeland Security Committee this week, what would you have told Peter King and his fellow members?
Oh, that's a good question. First and foremost, I would have told them that I do not have specialized knowledge of terrorism and that Muslims are not like the Borg collective, where we all share a singular consciousness. And it would be similar to me asking, you know, Italian Americans, hey, you know, I heard there's lots of mafioso types in your communities.
Yeah.
So let's have the cast of Jersey Shore come up and testify.
I think we can probably stipulate that, first of all, our counterterrorism agencies ought to do everything they can to stop American terrorists, Muslim and otherwise, from committing violence. But what ought to be done, do you think, by American Muslims to calm down their fellow Americans and make them less suspicious that you all get a memo about how to kill the rest of us?
You know, I mean, the reality is 9/11 happened, and 60% of Americans say they don't know a Muslim, and the favorability rating of Americans toward Islam and Muslims is lower now than it was in 2001. The holy trinity of occupations that we're allowed to have in many Muslim communities were the following: doctors, engineers, and dubious businessmen who somehow made a lot of money and drove a BMW. That left 10% for teachers, politicians, journalists, film directors, and so forth. So if we don't engage proactively and if we don't tell our story, as we see recently, our story will be told by others for us. And that story will paint a narrative in which Muslims only exist either as terrorists, Taliban, or taxicab drivers.
Your play, The Domestic Crusaders, you've tried very forthrightly to deal with this very issue. What's it about for those who haven't seen it, and why'd you write it?
The Domestic Crusaders is a story about a family that happens to be American, that happens to be Muslim, and that happens to have Pakistani origins, navigating a very tricky, complex time in 21st century America. If I've done my job, it's a universal story, but told through a culturally specific lens of a group of people whose voices we haven't really heard of in this way. You know, complex, messy, hypocritical, diverse, funny.
Yes. Now, your play was first staged, as I understand it, in the back of Pakistani restaurants around San Francisco, and now it's been produced in Washington and New York. We're going to play a scene from the play where the youngest son in this family, Ghafoor, has just told his family about being searched by TSA at airport security.
We'll sue the bastards.
Abul, relax. It's not that big of a deal.
What do you mean? Are you retarded? It's blatant racial profiling. They only nabbed you because you had an Arab-sounding name. That's the only reason.
Didn't I tell you to shave your beard before you came? Who gave you the brilliant idea to keep a beard? And you wore the topi? Oi, ullu? Why didn't you hold a sign saying, I'm an extremist? One-way ticket to Abu Ghraib, please.
Relax, Ami.
Now, I suppose your generation, this generation of Muslim writers in America, are going to be telling terrorism jokes pretty much for the the rest of my lifetime anyway.
You know, it's a very interesting comment you make, because there's many American Muslim artists up and coming who say, you know what, I want to get away from this frame of national security and terrorism. I just want to talk about, like, my bad coffee that I have in the morning. I want to do jokes about relationships. So why do I have to talk about religion or politics? The reality is that having a Muslim name, or even saying Muslim, is a politically charged word and identity in the 21st century. You can't escape it. If you want to hide under the rug, or the magic carpet, if you will, you can't escape it. And so the best way I've found is to confront this head on. And sometimes the best way to jumpstart that dialogue and to have a catharsis, you know, a healing, is through art, believe it or not.
On The Daily Show recently, Asif Manvi, who is Muslim, put together a fake, incredibly realistic-seeming fake TV pilot, bits of it, called The Cusby Show, Q-U-apostrophe-O-S-B-Y. I want to play a little bit of that.
Oh, you got a D in algebra? Now, why would you do that?
Oh, don't blow up at him again.
Why would you say that? Blow up? I would never do anything like that. That's just a very strange way to put things. Am I right?
I suppose what the real Cosby Show did for white Americans' embrace of black Americans in the 1980s, maybe we could use that these days. And I understand you're actually writing a TV pilot for HBO with Dave Eggers about a Muslim character.
You know, no, that would be strange if we actually pitched a Cosby Show to HBO. It's actually going to be a one-hour drama. The protagonist is an American Muslim cop set in the Bay Area.
Uh-huh.
And the intention behind that is, first and foremost, to create a really good show, a quality show with solid, you know, complex characters. It's very realistic, so that anyone who watches the TV says, I'm watching this show, it's a good show. Now, if they see that show and they say, oh, wow, look, Muslims are neither avatars of perfection or avatars of Armageddon and hellfire.
Yes.
I think in this day and age, that's a point worth making.
Wajahat Ali, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And please, please keep me and all sane heterosexual men as far away from your insane jihadi penguin squad as possible.
There's no one working in movies today quite like Steven Soderbergh. His debut film, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, pretty much launched the independent film movement 22 years ago. Soderbergh is still experimenting with idiosyncratic, low-budget art films, but then he swings back and makes big, commercially successful Hollywood movies. He's the only director ever nominated for two Best Director Oscars the same year, Aaron Brockovich and Traffic, and he won for Traffic. And actors like George Clooney and Matt Damon are regulars in his films. Next month, Damon stars in Soderbergh's new spy thriller, Haywire. I interviewed Steven Soderbergh recently in front of a huge audience of film lovers in Omaha. It was an event for Film Streams, the great local nonprofit theater where I'm on the board. I began by asking him how, after the huge success of Sex, Lies, and Videotape at age 26, his first movie, he dealt with the sophomore slump that lasted for most of the 1990s.
You can't do that today. You can't make two movies in a row now that people don't go see and get a job. So to make five films in a row that nobody saw, I mean, I was looking at a career of, you know, being in the art house ghetto for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And so when Out of Sight sort of came up, and I went and kind of auditioned for it behind a lot of other people, I really wanted that job. I needed that job.
And now you can visit the art house ghetto just occasionally.
Yeah. I'm renting.
Yeah. Was there a downside to having this tremendous success young?
No.
None? Okay, check. Was there a moment later on when you decided, okay, I can't think of myself as this wunderkind anymore? I'm now a grown-up, and I'm not going to get by on precocity any longer?
Well, you know, the issue of to what extent anybody who works in this business sort of lives in the third person is always interesting. And you have to be smart about how you view yourself and your own work. Everybody makes mistakes. I hope and I try not to make the same mistakes over and over again. And I'm a big believer in not looking up from your work. Just stay focused on what you're doing and don't get distracted by the other stuff, which is why after Traffic, I haven't read any reviews or anything about my own work in 12 years.
Really?
Are you upset?
I'm not at all. I'm fascinated by the restraint and discipline that would require.
It doesn't help. It doesn't help me.
Yeah.
And that was the sort of perfect time to do it because that was the year of Aaron and Traffic. And it was the perfect time to just kind of go,
it's
never going to get any better than this.
Yes.
You know, and it saves time. And
what are the, when you say you've made mistakes, what are the biggest mistakes you've made as a filmmaker?
I don't know if it's a mistake, but my sense is that the knock on me is that the films are kind of cold, with some exceptions, maybe Aaron. That the films are they're cold, they're intellectual, they're sort
liberal.
Of yeah, that the sort of macro design of them kind of drains some of the emotion out
but
of
that's
them.
But then you're getting back to the third person. That's a criticism. That's not a mistake.
Well,
unless you consider it a mistake, or
I don't know how to address that because I can only make it the way I can make it. The reason Aaron Brockovich is a warmer, more emotional film is because that's the way she is. And I was trying to service her character. And so in that context, I was not afraid at all of the emotion that she was bringing. But I'm also not willing to do anything to get a rise out of an audience. You know, I'd rather have something that feels human scale and not, that doesn't make you, the next day make you feel manipulated.
Yeah.
And so that may just be personal taste.
It seems to me you also, again, like an artist, are willing to fail and don't think, oh my God, if I make this movie and nobody sees it or people think it's weird or it gets bad reviews or whatever, then it's all over. And that doesn't seem to paralyze you, that fear.
Well, I'm a process person. I'm not a results person. So when it's done, it's kind of done. And I've been surprised in both directions by the responses to films that we've made. And you can't get yourself into a world where you're second-guessing,
right,
where you're trying to imagine what someone will like. You've just got to make something you like and hope that other people feel the same. And at the same time, look, we just wrapped shooting on this film, Contagion, which was written by Scott Burns, who wrote The Informant. This came about because Scott Burns and I spent 6 months working on a project about the documentary filmmaker Leni Riefenstahl, who made documentaries for the Nazis, basically. And suddenly I just said, nobody's going to go see this. Like, literally, it's going to be me and you. And I go, I can't do this anymore. I can't spend 2 years making no money on something that I know no one is going to see. And I said, what else have you got? And he goes, well, I want to make a movie about a pandemic. I go, let's do that.
Yeah. Is that a different calculation at 47 and 48 than it was at 37 and 38?
Yeah, it's partially age, and it's partially, again, you know, it's a public art form. I mean, you want people to see them, even though you may look at some of my choices and think, I don't believe that.
On Studio 360 last month, I interviewed your friend and collaborator, Matt Damon, who I guess you just finished your sixth film with him, Contagion. And I asked him about this next one that he mentioned that he's working on with you, a biopic about Liberace, in which he plays, I guess, a lover of Liberace's. This part of my interview with him didn't air on the show, and I just wanted to play my question and his answer about why he likes working with you.
It's just a fascinating story. Richard LeGravenaise wrote the script, and so it's just great. And Steve and I, you know, I want to work with as much as I can. Obviously, I've done six with him now, and he says he's going to retire, and he means it. So he's interested mostly in kind of formally what he can do, and he's kind of exhausted just about everything at this point and feels like he's young enough that he could really devote himself. I mean, he's got an unbelievable work ethic, and if he applies himself, he has time to have a whole new career as either a painter or a photographer.
It's kind of amazing that he recalled the conversation that well, because we were both really drunk. And I mistakenly assumed that the level of inebriation would bring along with it a kind of entre nous.
A cone of silence?
Yeah, yeah. That being said, that's a very articulate description of something that took me about 20 minutes to say. But when you reach the point where you're like, if I have to get into another van to do another scout, I'm just going to shoot myself. It's time to let somebody else who's still excited about getting in the van get in the van. And so it's just time. For the last 3 years, I've been turning down everything that comes my way. So
instead of...
You're not going to have Steven Soderbergh to kick around anymore. Yeah.
And now you could run for president like the man who said that did.
Yeah.
It's as if you've had this really interesting 15-year run of straddling, of making Ocean's movies and these big movies and then doing these interesting artistic experiments to some degree. It's as though you've decided you don't want to do that straddle anymore and you're just going to go in the say goodbye to entertainment and say hello to art.
Well, it's a sense of just having been there before. The making of any art is just problem solving. And as you work at it, you're able to eliminate the versions that aren't any good faster. But at a certain point, the solves sort of become the same. And when I started feeling like I've done this shot before, I've done a scene that's about this before, that's when I started thinking seriously about, you know, a shift. But I don't want to leave. You know, when you see one of those athletes like hang on like two seasons too long, you know, it's kind of sad, you know, because then your last image of them isn't when they were great. It was kind of
texting sexual pictures of themselves. So. Yeah.
I think it was the Crocs that got me. You know, I got two that I'm finishing and two more to make that people could go, you should have quit 2 years ago.
But it's interesting, but if you really are doing this and I take you seriously, it seems to me it will make these two really exciting.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, especially to do Liberace with Matt and Michael Douglas and to do Man from U.N.C.L.E. with George, you know, that's...
George Clooney playing Napoleon Solo.
Yeah, that's...
Kids, it was a big show in the 60s.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great way to sort of step off.
Can't wait. Steven Soderbergh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Steven Soderbergh's latest film is the Spalding Gray documentary, And Everything is Going Fine. His new movie, Haywire, comes out next month. Coming up...
That old black magic has me in its spell.
Pulling rabbits out of hats? That's for amateurs. How about eating light bulbs?
It's
It's a Sylvania 60 watt.
Yeah, I usually eat 100 watt bulbs, but I'm on a diet.
That happens in Teller's new show, Play Dead. And it's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
I should stay away. What can I do? I hear your name and I'm aflame.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I'm sitting in a theater in the West Village in New York City. The lights fade to black, and it's so dark I can't even see my hand in front of my face. The pure darkness surrounded by 100 strangers is weird enough, but now I'm feeling something rushing past me. Finally, the lights come back on.
Good evening. I am Todd Robbins, and tonight, with your consent, I'm going to invite Death to come out and play.
On stage is Todd Robbins. He's our guide to this night of macabre stories and tricks called Play Dead. Actually, he's more like a gleeful troublemaker than a guide.
And hereby give me permission to lead you down into the darkness, to turn on you, to betray your trust, to do to you whatever suits my purpose.
Play Dead is the brainchild of Robbins and of another quite famous magician, Teller, the short, silent half of Penn and Teller. But when the subject is death, it turns out, you can hardly get Teller to stop talking. We caught up at the theater just before a performance.
It comes out of a great American tradition of spook shows. A clever and cheesy idea done starting in the late 1920s when a crazy magician got the idea that you could draw a late-night crowd with magic tricks that were on the theme of the resurrection of the dead. Uh-huh. They really were a bunch of teenagers who were thrown into the darkness with, like, you know, spaghetti being thrown at them so that they could scream and grope each other. What we wanted to do is to do a really artistic version of this, and for adults.
Right.
And so we really began to think about what is really our attitude towards death.
So really the subject is death in a not entirely humorous fashion.
The subject is death in a complicated, fun fashion. Todd and I share a belief about death, which is that the dead are dead, but they do exist in one place. They exist inside us. So the only place my parents are still alive is in me. They're in my genes. They're in my memories. And the idea that the dead are inside us is actually a joyful thought if you approach it that way. The idea that someone says, you don't have the dead inside you, I can give them to you for a price, is the way spirit mediums made their money and still do now. There are people,
sometimes on television shows.
Television shows all the time. Hideous, horrible, hateful people do that. And so the message of our show is the dead are inside us and we should be really happy about that. And once you get there, then we start to have fun with that as well. And then at one point we actually borrow a member of the audience and physically bring out a, you know, naked spirit of a 1920s spirit medium.
Yes.
Come to Mama. Yes. Write it to me.
Should we look at some of the stuff around the stage? I mean, it is haunted housey. Mm-hmm. And then, as the show goes on, Todd goes from box to box as though there are the dead in these boxes. Are there remains? Are there essences?
Well, there
essences,
are artifacts, yes, little memorabilia. And we never claim that they're real memorabilia because we don't want to insult the intelligence of the audience. They know.
It's theater.
Yes, that this is play. But we have, there's Hezekiah Trembles.
1921 to 1982.
Who was Congo the Jungle Boy, who ate live animals.
If you bite the head of a chicken, you can nick an artery so that it gushes or maybe it spurts.
David P. Abbott is the author of Behind the Scenes with the Mediums, the most thoroughly informative and important research book on fraudulent spirit mediumship. Fraudulent's redundant, of course.
So he was doing it before Houdini got into the act of debunking mediums.
Yes. Well, Houdini got into it mostly after his mother died. When she died, he visited Sir Arthur Conan Doyle in Atlantic City. And Mrs. Doyle, who was a believer in spiritualism, did automatic writing. She brought forth a message to Houdini, ostensibly from his dead mother. Unfortunately, she wrote it in English, and she put a cross at the top. And since she couldn't speak English, and her husband was a rabbi, Houdini thought this was perhaps an unlikely message.
Yes. Now, this tank, this beautiful coffin-sized...
sort of a dye vat.
Where an audience member dies each night in the show.
Well, yes, it's called Play Dead, yes. So we invite someone up on stage to play dead. The person plays deader than they expect to play. No one has ever before wanted to bring an audience member up on stage, kill him, and dissolve his body in acid. We wanted to do that. You know, when you hear the audience react to it, they go, "Oh!" and then they burst out laughing.
Tell me about the ghost light, which we have here.
The ghost light is an image that I think, you know, always symbolizes the theater because it's just such a powerful image of light in darkness. And since so much of this show is about the difference between the experience of the world when you're plunged into darkness, it seemed like really the central image of the show.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things we do towards the beginning of the show is Todd comes out and eats it.
Yes, the light bulb. It's interesting about light and dark. I mean, there is a certain moment, long moments in this show where the entire theater is entirely dark, which is simply not an experience one has in the city in modern times very often.
And plunging yourself into the darkness with a group of strangers it's fascinating to find out. I mean, we have eyes on people in the dark.
Really? So you have some kind of infrared glasses, people monitoring the whole...
Something like that. We have to do that for safety.
Yeah. So people, you see in your monitoring in the dark that people do weird things from the audience?
People do mostly very affectionate things.
Uh-huh.
Todd does remind me of the evening that he invited a gentleman up on stage, and the gentleman had to take a moment to rebuckle his pants before he came up.
Really?
Yes.
Did he know how long the lights were going to be off?
I suppose neither he nor his date did.
Huh. It's interesting, too, as a theatrical experience. I'm surprised that darkness isn't used more in the theater, which you use so beautifully in this show.
When we started off, we didn't know how powerful the experience of being in the dark is and how you lose your sense of space and how you begin to either trust or mistrust the person next to you, in front of you, behind you, and how that sends shivers through people if you do nothing at all.
Yes.
The opening darkroom section of our show, essentially, we're doing nothing at all. But then in the second darkroom in the show, we pull out all the stops and do everything that you've ever seen in a motion picture, a depiction of, you know, seances with ghosts and spirits. And we're using, interestingly, I mean, to me, we're using technology that was around in the days when spirit mediums really were.
This is how they fooled people.
Yeah, but we're doing it much better.
Yeah.
I mean, you could, in those days, you could, if you have a believer, you can get away with dragging out a little piece of cheesecloth in red light. If you have an audience of sophisticated New York theater goers,
yeah,
you want, you know, towering, translucent spirits that float over your heads and trumpets that speak into your ear.
It would be interesting almost to, as an experiment, to bring some credulous people in and say you're really doing it and seeing if you could fool them.
It's, you know, it's a huge moral point in the show that we don't do that. And Todd actually outdoes any of the spirit mediums you'll see on TV with doing personal readings to people.
Your friend Jack is talking to him.
Yeah, and Todd never pretends that it's real.
And the fact, as you say, that people are on the verge of believing it even as he is saying this is BS.
Yeah. We rewrote the show after one of our experiences in Las Vegas, where Todd was doing one of these astonishing readings for somebody. It was, in fact, the thing in which a name is formed in ashes on a sheet. And he had a gray-haired man named Juan up on stage. And Juan's mother's name appeared in ash on the sheet. And Juan burst into tears. And we thought, that's not what this show's about. This show's about the joy of playing with this stuff. So we rewrote the show so that that would never happen again. Because you don't come to the theater for that. You come to the theater for joy.
Yeah. Now, we've had you on Studio 360 before. You obviously speak. Yet, as Teller and Penn & Teller, you don't speak. Are people, when they meet you in the world, still surprised to hear a voice emerge?
My favorite story on this happened in Times Square. I was walking through Times Square one night. It was very crowded, and a cop stuck out his nightstick, stopping me in the chest. You know, and he turned to me and said, "Name?" I said, tell her. And he turned to his partner and said, see, I knew I could make him talk.
Good use of our NYPD resources, I think. Teller, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Play Dead is at the Players Theater off Broadway in New York City, and it may run, for all we know, into eternity. And right now at our website, a video of Todd eating and chewing and swallowing a light bulb.
Tastes like chicken.
Crispy chicken.
For real, I swear. Go to studio360.org and be prepared to cringe. Roger Waters, the former lead singer of Pink Floyd, is touring again right now. He's recreating down to the last detail Pink Floyd's original 1980 live tour of The Wall, including a 40-foot-high wall and giant puppets. 31 years ago, The Wall was one of the biggest-selling albums in rock history. Now it sounds a little like, oh, maybe one of the biggest dinosaurs? It was a double LP, a concept album that only makes sense if you listen to all 81 minutes from beginning to end. And its central metaphor, the Berlin Wall, which would be torn down at the end of that decade. But Studio 360's Eric Molinsky thinks The Wall isn't a relic. He says it's a genuine classic.
The Wall was big. It sold over 30 million copies. It inspired a movie adaptation that was directed by Alan Parker. Parker didn't realize how big The Wall was until they brought the movie to the Soviet Union.
I went on stage beforehand. I said, how many of you have ever seen this film? And 3,500 kids, communist kids who had no access to the film, put their hand up because it was the most successful bootlegged and illegal video in Soviet times.
Bootlegging. That's what Soviet kids did before downloading. Back when there were Soviet kids. Back when there was a wall dividing Berlin. And those aren't even the biggest anachronisms of The Wall, according to Chuck Klosterman, who writes about rock music.
For a record that's sort of directed at a 15-year-old, it's very heavy. I mean, philosophically heavy. I still think it gives high school kids a lot of credit to assume that this is what a high school kid would want to hear.
Hey, you. Out there in the cold, getting lonely, getting old, can you feel me?
Kids were deep back then. Or at least they were into being deep. Again, here's Alan Parker, who directed the movie.
We were given the money by a man called David Beagleman, and David Beagleman was running MGM at the time, and then he shook my hand and he said to me, he said, Alan, are you sure this is going to be okay? He said, because to be honest with you, I don't understand it at all. Not only that, no one in this company understands it. Not only that, my 19-year-old son, who's a Pink Floyd fan, he doesn't understand it either.
What I like about that period of Pink Floyd is they just kept saying, f*** it, let's just make it bigger. We'll just keep going.
Wayne Coyne is the lead singer of the Flaming Lips. He is a big Pink Floyd fan.
I mean, frankly, I want my surgeon and my airline pilot and maybe my banker now to be cautious and worry about the future. But I don't really want musicians like that. I want them, if they want to be pompous and they want to be f***ing egotistical idiots, I say, give them money and let them do it.
So what exactly was The Wall about?
So ya thought ya might like to go to the show.
A rock star who's damaged goods. His father was killed in World War II. His mother smothered him, so he's terrible with women. And he turns his concerts into fascist rallies.
Are there any queers in the theater tonight? Get them up against the wall.
At the end of the album, he's put on trial by all the miserable people in his life.
The evidence before the court is incontrovertible. There's no need for the jury to retire.
And they sentence him to tear down his emotional wall. It was really personal to Roger Waters, the lead singer. And a little too personal for some fans, even Wayne Coyne.
That anger that Roger Waters seemed so determined to tell the world about. To me, it just goes, after a while, I'm like, dude, I don't care.
The Wall also tries the patience of Chuck Klosterman, the rock critic.
The Wall would not improve by making it into a single album, despite the fact that, at its current length, it is kind of boring.
In 1979, kids would sit down and listen to The Wall all the way from beginning to end, like reading a book. In fact, they'd probably rather do that than read a book. But a nuanced album like The Wall, today in the era of the iPod shuffle, would probably be a flop.
The songs that get big now are the ones that pretty much on first listen give you the full experience.
Now, there were two big hit singles on The Wall, Comfortably Numb and Another Brick in the Wall. Bob Ezrin produced the album. He says there wouldn't even be any singles if Pink Floyd had had their way.
The band basically said, we don't do singles. So it was kind of like, screw you, buddy. So I was sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place. I had a song with one verse and one chorus, and that was it. They refused to play it any longer. And so when they went home that night, we just copied it. It's exactly the same backing track, first and second verse. And the only difference was that we added kids to the second verse.
And he added a disco beat, so Another Brick in the Wall could secretly cross over to the discotheques.
There was no secret about it. I was trying to make a dance record.
But Chuck Klosterman thinks it's exactly here where The Wall is showing its age.
Some of the really straightforward teen stuff on The Wall. You know, the idea of, like, you know, teachers leave these kids alone. Like, you know, this idea that like, you were sort of at war with just the idea of authority in general. You know, now it's so different because it's not abnormal for, say, a 58-year-old parent to own some of the same music on their iPod as their 16-year-old kid.
And that parent would be trying to get his kid to appreciate The Wall.
What's your feeling? What's your feeling about the record?
At the end of my interview with Wayne Coyne of the Flaming Lips, he turned the question around on me. I didn't discover The Wall to the late 1980s because MTV kept rerunning the movie.
I seem to be one of the few people that absolutely loves it. I loved it as a teenager. As a 15-year-old, 16-year-old, it really spoke to me. I even loved the boring parts. I loved every nook and cranny of it.
I mean, if you love that record, it's a great record. No one can rightfully ever come up and say, you know, that music that you like, it's not any good. You're like, no, dude, if I like it, it's good.
And, you know, the politics of The Wall really aren't that outdated either. Or at least Roger Waters doesn't think so. Yes, in 1979, The Wall on everyone's mind was the Berlin Wall. But now Roger Waters is focusing on Israel. He wants to perform The Wall at the separation barrier that divides Israel from the West Bank. He won't schedule the concert until the barrier comes down, just like he did in Berlin in 1990. In the meantime, he's asking artists to boycott Israel, and of course getting a lot of flack for it. But Bob Ezrin, who produced the album, doesn't need a political cause to believe in The Wall. Or as Wayne Coyne would put it, no, dude, if he likes it, it's good.
And the thing about The Wall is it talks about alienation and loss and separation, a feeling of aloneness, which is something that I think certainly every teenager goes through. And many people in their early 20s, you know, people just feel like nobody knows, nobody understands, nobody cares. This is not me. You do not understand. This is not who I am. I have become comfortably numb.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
If you want to feel young again, or if you are actually young, The Wall Tour from Roger Waters is happening right now. Visit our website, studio360.org, to find out where. Coming up, you can't go home again? Really? You can try.
I don't know how much profanity Steinbeck used, but I'm sure that he would have had a few choice phrases for some of the changes that had occurred here in his hometown.
Traveling in the footsteps of John Steinbeck. That's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
you see. Do the folks I used to know remember me?
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
You never give me your money. You only give me your funny paper. And in the middle of negotiations, you break down.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. With government budgets everywhere across the country seriously squeezed, we've been taking a look at how cuts are affecting the arts. Last week, we asked you to tell us what was going on in your community. A guy calling himself DJ in Chicago writes that he's a major supporter of the arts, but that, quote, taxes should not ever be used to fund the arts. Those of us who care enough about these programs and institutions should demonstrate our commitment by donating money, time, and other resources to the causes we feel most passionately about. Taxation is equal to theft. On the other hand, we heard from a couple of listeners, not quite so libertarian, who were worried about arts education.
My name is Tom Gardner. I perform with a group called the Uncle Brothers in Rockland County, New York.
The Uncle Brothers perform at school assemblies and sing songs about bullying and saying no to drugs.
New Jersey, New York, which is our main market, both those budgets have been cut horribly. Most important part is the programs in schools that need it the most are the ones that have the least, because they don't have strong PTAs to raise funds.
Hi, my name is Lois Bjornson, and I live in Scenery Hill, Pennsylvania.
She says the arts have completely disappeared from the schools there.
However, what is still hugely flourishing is football. I like sports, but I think it's way over the top how much money is always given to them. I think people's viewpoints are completely reversed because, after all, you can carry any of the arts with you for the rest of your life. You can't really carry playing football with you till the day you die. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All the money's gone. Nowhere to go.
We want to keep hearing what's going on in your community. Are there important arts programs that are facing big cuts? And if so, what ought to be done about that? Tell us at studio360.org or give us a call at 646-580-0360. The writer John Steinbeck was born at the turn of the 20th century just outside Monterey, California. In 1960, though, he was a famous author living in New York and embarked on a road trip up and down and across the United States with his dog, Charlie. He wrote about that trip in his book, Travels with Charlie in Search of America. We've been revisiting some of the stops on his journey, and for our final installment, we retrace his trip back to Monterey. Steinbeck hadn't been back in years, and what he saw appalled him. Our guide in Monterey today is a writer and teacher who disagrees with Steinbeck about change and about whether it's possible to go home again.
So we're in downtown Monterey, and the buildings themselves probably aren't much different from the ones that Steinbeck saw when he was growing up here in the area. He probably came to this cinema, the Golden State Cinema. Golden State Theater. Lots of gulls. That hasn't changed much. And if you inhale deeply, the ocean's to our left and behind us, all over there. You can sort of catch a scent of the sea breeze and kelp and rotting sea life. It's still there. I'm Diana Garcia. I'm a poet and writer and a professor in the Creative Writing and Social Action Program at California State University, Monterey Bay.
Just a little bit longer.
So I'm reading from Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie in Search of America. As part of his journey, he comes home again. And he goes to Johnny's bar, the Galician. And to Steinbeck's horror, he starts hearing the word dead, dead, dead after he brings up the names of several of the old-time friends. And that's around the time when he starts talking about Thomas Wolfe's concept that you can never go home again, that there's been too much change and it's not for the better. When he left, there was still a fishing industry. When he returned, that fishing industry was in tatters. The wharves were crumbling, the canneries were shut down, and he tells his friend Johnny, "Today I walked the length of Alvarado Street and back by the Calle Principal, and I saw nothing but strangers.
Nothing but strangers. My nerves are jangled by traffic lights. Even the police are strangers, foreigners." Johnny was slumped casually over the bar. "But here, Juanito, it's the same. We don't let them in." I looked down the line of faces. "Yes, here it is better. But can I live on a bar stool? Let us not kid ourselves. What we knew is dead, and maybe the greatest part of what we were is dead. What's out there is new and perhaps good, but it's nothing we know."
Steinbeck realized if the discussion continued, it was going to lead to a fight, that the next words were going to be, "Let's step outside and settle this." And so instead, he left. And later on talks about how he not only leaves Monterey, but in a sense, flees Monterey.
"It's a lonesome old town."
This four-lane concrete highway slash with speeding cars.
I remember as a narrow, twisting mountain road where the wood teams moved, drawn by steady mules.
This was a little, little town.
Little town. A general store under a tree and a blacksmith shop, and a bench in front on which to sit and listen to the clang of hammer on anvil. Now little houses, each one like the next, particularly since they try to be different, spread for a mile in all directions. That was a woody hill with live oaks dark green against the parched grass where the coyotes sang on moonlit nights. The top is shaved off and a television relay station lunges at the sky and feeds a nervous picture to thousands of tiny houses clustered like aphids beside the roads.
I've been reading Steinbeck since I was about 10 years old. He was the first author to make a deep impact on me. Growing up the child of farm workers, he talked about the Salinas Valley. He may as well have been talking about the San Joaquin Valley. He talked about agriculture, talked about the native peoples, talked about the Mexicans. It all sounded very familiar. It felt very like home to me. For me, this issue of coming home, I feel like I'm always coming home. I live so close to my parents in Merced. I've seen the orchards being torn down. I've seen the crops disked under. And then I've seen the forms being laid, the curbs and gutters and the driveways being poured. I've seen those changes. And I feel that I can go home because I've experienced them individually, minutely, over a period of time. They haven't come on me as a shock. You know, the freeway went through our part of town when I was about 12 years old, and it destroyed that entire community forever at that point. When that happened, I didn't see it as destruction at that time so much as work for my father, because he was one of the cement masons working on the abutments and the sidewalks and the overpasses. And so it's a very different reality. So now we're on Cannery Row itself, with the Cannery Row trolley tooling up and down the street, tourists crossing at their risks. We have the pizzerias, the beer joints, candy companies, and of course, we're standing right now in front of the bust of John Steinbeck, who immortalized Cannery Row with his book titled Cannery Row. You know, I don't know how much profanity Steinbeck used, but he's always struck me as kind of a working class kind of guy, and I'm sure that he would have had a few choice phrases for some of the changes that had occurred here in his hometown. I don't think he would have cared for it. I don't see that for myself. We are always in a process of breaking down and building back up, both as humans and as an environment and as communities. If it weren't so, then we probably would cease to exist.
That's poet Diana Garcia in Monterey, California. Our series retracing John Steinbeck's travels with Charlie was produced by John Biewen of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. Have you ever returned to where you grew up and had an epiphany, for better or for worse? If so, we'd like to hear about it at studio360.org. That's it for today's show. Thanks very much for listening. And between now and the next episode, be sure to check out our tweets and blogging at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Michael Guerriero,
Sarah D'Elia,
Mary Du.
Special thanks this week to FilmStream's Rachel Jacobson and Omaha Performing Arts' Kate Williams. And thanks, as ever, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
It's not important that I'm Catherine Deneuve. I know he loves me for what I'm deeply.
At 67, Deneuve is still the bomb.
He understands I cannot talk about feelings. He lets me show him in other ways.
The actress Catherine Deneuve, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.